Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 22 says, "The blessing of Yahweh, it maketh rich and addeth no sorrow with it." This will be Principles of Biblical Economics, part 14. And we are back again from a short series concerning the war in Iraq. And let me take this opportunity to point out that no matter what is going on around us on a national or international scale, no matter what the New World Order boys are up to, or no matter what designs or evil machinations the Antichrist have up their sleeves, we need to always, I mean, not that those things sometimes don't need to be addressed, not that they don't need to be exposed, however, we need to, after we've done so, to always get back to focusing on what we need to be doing, not just on what they're doing to us. If we only focus our attention on the ground that they're taking away from us, like many ministries are prone to do, we'll never be about the business of taking back the ground they've stolen from us. And therefore, we need to be about focusing. We need to get back to focusing in on the different aspects of doing whatever it is God would have us to do to help bring about His kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven. That is, dominionizing, if you will, to put it in one word. And a large part of dominionizing, hopefully you figured this out by now, by the 14th part of the series, that a large part of dominionizing, whether you're on their side or our side, it doesn't just work for their side. It's worked pretty good. But a large part of dominionizing is economics. To put it bluntly, until Christendom figures this out, we will never take dominion back completely from the Antichrist and the non-Christians. In other words, we will never truly, without this area being dealt with, and without putting it into our lives, applying it into our lives on an individual basis, and then hopefully at some point on a national basis, until then, we will never truly be the salt of the earth and a light to the world. Don't you think that this is part of what being a salt of the earth and a light to the world is? I mean, I think about salt and light that God intends for us is all meant to bring about freedom. Let me tell you, we're in economic slavery now. And thus, we'll never be the salt of the earth. The earth. For those who may hear this and never had that aspect really emphasized as it should be, and a light to the world without dealing and addressing and applying this area of life. Think about it. With most of Christendom's worldview as it is, which is actually no worldview at all, the only view they actually have is for heaven. Whether... And I don't care which part of most of Christendom we're talking about, whether they're a part of the left behind crowd or not. The only view that most of Christendom has is for heaven. That's just about it. And with no worldview to speak of, their light, therefore, amounts to a quick probe into the darkness to grab someone and to quickly bring them into their church building. That is, think about it, under a very large bushel basket. You see, their children are all singing, "Hide it under a bushel, no." While the majority of their parents are doing precisely just that, because they do not have a proper perspective of a worldview. It's bring them into the church, hide them under that big bushel basket. There is the light. The light sure shines bright in those church buildings. But it's not going out there. It's just a quick probe out and grab somebody and bring them in. And then many times take away their effectiveness or some effectiveness they might have otherwise. Listen to me. You've heard me say it many times, and I'm going to continue to say it probably until the day I stop preaching. And that is, this is our world, and it should be ours to change this world. That is, to take or establish Christian dominion, not just to remove people out of the world. Economics, biblical economics, that is, beginning with our lives, with a long-range view for the entire nation. And someday, you know, if we get it, if Christianity gets it down, it won't be a long-range view. It won't have to be a long-range view. It'll be right around the corner if we can just get people to wake up to this aspect of dominionizing and many of the others as well. But economics, biblical economics, beginning with our lives with a long-range view for our entire nation is a large, let me share it, tell you, a large part of our doing so, of our being a light, of our being the salt, of our dominionizing and establishing the kingdom of God here on earth as it is in heaven. Now, in the previous messages, for a quick review, we have, and I'll say quote-unquote covered, because I'm sure there's much, much more. I know that there's much more that could be said about all of these principles. Let's just say that I've addressed the following eight biblical principles of economics. Number one, seek first His kingdom and His righteousness. And for those who may be on the tape ministry new and haven't heard the previous series, let me assure you, that is a biblical economic principle. That's the foundation of all economic principles. Seek first His kingdom and His righteousness. Number two, seek wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. Number three, seek work. And all of these come out not out of some motivational speaker's program. This all comes out of the Bible. Number three is seek work. Number four, tithing, free will offerings, and charitable contributions. Number five, efficient and effective time management. Number six, Sabbath. Number seven, save, save, and save. Number eight, stay out of debt. Now, we're not quite finished, as I pointed out in the last message concerning staying out of debt. We're not quite finished with principle number eight, which is, whatever you do, do what you have to stay out of debt. Whatever you do, do what you have to stay out of debt, or what the Bible calls slavery. And if you're in debt or slavery, do whatever you have to get out of debt as quickly as you possibly can. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand and like a bird from the hand of the fowler. As Solomon put it in Proverbs 6 and verse 5, talking about get yourself out of debt. It's like you're the hunted when you're in debt. Someone once put it in the following fashion. They said that if you're going to borrow, at the very least, borrow from a pessimist, because he won't expect it back. Problem is, it's hard to find those kind of lenders. There are not very many of them that are pessimists. The fact is, Yahweh expects, He wants us to be the lenders and not the borrowers. Read Deuteronomy 28 if you don't believe that. It's the blessing of Yahweh that makes us the lenders. It's the curse of Yahweh that makes us the borrowers. He wants us to be the lenders, not the borrowers, as we dealt with in the previous message. And by the way, if you are the lender, you are to do so expecting nothing in return. Yes, I'm thinking of the same person you are. According to Luke chapter 6 and verse 35. Of course, if you're the borrower, then it's your obligation to do your absolute best to repay the lender, even if that person doesn't expect it back. Now, I understand, I completely understand, I assure you, that in this day in which we live, it's a whole lot easier said than to accomplish what I'm talking about, to stay out of debt or to get out of debt. It's easy to say that. And I know and I understand that that's not all that easy sometimes. Everything today is inflated and costs nearly a fortune. A couple was overheard in a restaurant once. A fellow said, "Well, Mary, near as I can figure, based on the price of the ham dinner you just ate, we've got a hog back in the farm that's worth at least $137,000. Now, I'm not encouraging eating ham, but the fact is still the fact. Inflation, by the way, is the price that we pay as a nation for all the government benefits that we thought were free, along with a crummy insurance business. Industry, thank you. What we pay for example, what we pay for automobiles today was not all that long ago in our father's day, or what our fathers in their day used to pay for a house, and a pretty fancy one at that. This last week, as those of you here know already, two of our children had to have all four impacted wisdom teeth taken out of their mouths. I suspect that I've got two more coming on here as well. Now, we had two children, all four impacted teeth taken out of their mouth. It cost an average of $1,300 per child. Now, that's, if you do the math, if you do the division, that's $325 a tooth. Now, back in the 30s, Linda's father had all four of his teeth taken out at one time. Would you like to venture a guess how much it cost him to have four impacted teeth taken out in the 30s? Anybody? $20. Anybody else? $200. Well, Herschel wins the contest. Not quite, but pretty close. Cost him $18. $18 to get all four teeth out. That's $4.50 per tooth then versus $350 a tooth now. I'd say that's inflation. And those are expenses that, for the most part, those are the kind of expenses that we can't avoid. And you start thinking about it. You know, I've got children. I've got four children, two already, two to come probably, that you've got to have the teeth taken out. That's $1,300. You do the math times four. I mean, that's big dollars. And that's just one of many things that we sometimes have as necessities today that have to be taken care of. And you can see why it's so difficult to stay ahead of the ball game. You know, we're constantly being faced with these tremendous inflated prices. And therefore, it's a tough situation that we face in this day and age. But let me tell you that there are many expenses that we sometimes consider essential that are not near as essential as we might sometimes think that they are. We've just been programmed to think that, you know, this is necessary and that's necessary, or I've got to do it this way and this way, the same way that everybody else is doing it. Take homes, for example, and we talked about that in the last message. But let me camp on this one, because this one's especially difficult for people to get a hold of. Let's take homes, for example. Now, a place to live is essential, unless you were Christ, who didn't have even a pillow to lay his head upon. But that doesn't mean, a place to live is essential, but that doesn't mean that you have to go into debt or slavery for the next 30 years plus to own a home in order to have a place, a residence to stay in. And therefore, pay over these 30 plus years, pay who knows how many times more than the selling price or its worth by the time that you pay the original price and the loan sharks compound interest rates on top of it. Now, let me read to you a short, it's not too long, explanation of this. It comes from Martin Larson, who was a usual contributor in the Spotlight newspaper, in an article called Our World in Conflict, the column was called Our World in Conflict. And I'm sure, Bob, you've read Martin Larson many times. This particular article was called Debt Slavery and really explains it well. Listen carefully, because there's a lot of figures, but I want you to try to catch as much of this as you can. He said, a bright young couple, both perhaps working for wages, have, let us say, saved $45,000. They decide to buy a house priced at $180,000, which may be a rather modest in some parts of the country. They take out a 30-year mortgage for the remainder, of course, which would be $135,000 with interest at 10%. Little, I suspect, do they realize what a burden they have placed on their future lives. The Bible calls it slavery. Don't forget that. If they are 25 or 35 years old, the obligation will not be liquidated until they are 55 or 60 years old, unless they can find means of making substantial additional payments, such as a bequest from their parents. Additional payments will not apply to immediately forthcoming payments, but will simply reduce the principal debt. If they fail to make the regular payments, the lender can seize the property no matter how much has already been paid. Various emergencies may arise which will make it impossible to meet the obligation. And again, I get shared the figures on how many foreclosures there are yearly. I forget what it is now, but it's in the previous message. And just think, they can take that at any point in time. They can be a 1 year from paying off that house, come into an emergency, and lose everything they've put into it to that point. Going on with this article, there may be serious illnesses. The principal earner may die or become ill, or there may be unemployment which will terminate a paycheck. The cards are stacked high in the favor of the lender, and the homeowner has little defense. Let us consider the debt of $135,000. This will require interest payments, listen to this, of about $13,500 the first year. And the principal itself will be reduced only very slowly for several years. The contract will require 360 payments of $1,125 for a total of $405,000. In short, the borrower will pay $270,000 more than he obtained in the first place. Payments annually will total $14,736 and will reduce the debt by little more than $1,200 the first year. During the second year, each payment will reduce the principal a few more dollars, but it will take about 10 years to reduce the debt by $20,000. Thus, after 120 payments totaling $147,000, the homeowner will still be struggling with a debt of more than $115,000. End of what I'm quoting from his article. Now, that's $405,000 for a $135 loan or home. Now, they already had the $45,000, but let's say for a loan. $405,000 for a $135,000 loan. Now, listen to me. If you can afford monthly payments on a house that you've gone into debt for of $1,125 a month from that point on for 30 years, if you can afford to make payments on that load of that much, then you can afford to save that every month when not going into debt, right? While you rent. And in 10 years, let's say that you can come up with that in addition to whatever rent may be, but you can come up with that additional money. That would mean that in 10 years, you could buy that same home outright and save $270,000. Now, that's never told our people. Now, you say, yeah, but what if I can't afford? But I don't have that extra money, and I've got to put it into rent. Well, it's very doubtful. You know, anybody can probably find something to rent for half of that kind of payment. So let's say you're paying $500 or $600. Well, you'd be able to buy the home in 20 years, not counting what God might do to bless you for not going into debt in the first place. And you'd still be $270,000 ahead. Or let's say you can't find anything that's adequate for your situation, and it's going to cost you the same amount of money for rent as it would for payments on a house. Well, then you buy the house in 30 years, and you save $270,000. Let me tell you, this whole thing is a scam. And somebody's getting rich while you're in slavery and you're getting poorer. Let me just share you a little cowboy wisdom again. You know, us cowboys aren't near as dumb as sometimes you think. Here's a little cowboy wisdom. Quote, debt doubles the weight on your horse and puts another in control of the reins. End of quote. If you're a cowboy, let me tell you, you don't want to be sitting behind the guy in the saddle. You want to be in the saddle. You want to have control of the reins. Now listen to me, young people especially, because some of us older folks, it's too late. Not too late for us to try to get out, but too late for us for having already got in. We've either been there, some of us, or we're still there. But young people, rent. When it comes to a home, place, you got to have a place to live, rent. And save until you can afford to buy without going into debt. And yes, I've heard all the arguments that there are for renting, but keep this in mind. None of those arguments, none of them, stack up against the fact that the Bible simply tells us don't go into debt, no matter what the system is around us, period. Now, yes, there's always the monthly payment that's when you're renting. That's often described as putting money down a rat hole. That's just what they want you to think about it. I don't know, would I rather put monthly payments toward rent that goes down a rat hole, or would I rather put an extra $270,000 down a rat hole? And I may lose all in the long run anyway. I mean, there's no guarantee I'm going to be able to keep it. And so, yeah, I've heard that argument. But listen to me, you can always walk away from it and find something less expensive if you have to. There's always something less expensive. And yes, you can also walk away from a house you're buying too. However, walk away from a rental and you've lost nothing. Walk away from a house you have a loan on and you lose all the equity and whatever collateral you may have put up as well. Proverbs chapter 22, 26 and 27 again says, "Do not be among those who give pledges, among those who become sureties for debts. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should you? Why should he take your bed from you as well?" I mean, that's a warning right there of what can happen. Now, I'm talking in all of this about living within your means. We live in a society today that doesn't know the meaning of that. They don't know what it means to live within your means. And who are people who need to remember, who need to remind themselves of the times when they looked forward to receiving a salary that they somehow now can't live on. You remember the days? You look back and you say, "Wow, I would love to have the salary I have now." And now we can't live on it. You know, something's wrong with that picture. Listen to me. The only place a person can find financial security, and you know, you hear that. People are always looking for financial security, right? Boy, you want that. I'm here to tell you, the only place you can find financial security is inside your income. That's it. That's the only place you can find financial security. Some of you have probably heard the saying, when your outgo exceeds your income, then your upkeep will be your downfall. Let me say it again. When your outgo exceeds your income, then your upkeep will be your downfall. Plain and simple. Also, if you're not happy with what you have now, think about this. If you're not happy with what you have now, always wanting something more, if you're not happy with what you have now, how in the world could you be happier with more of what you're not happy with? The truth is, most people want what they don't need and need what they don't want. Really described well in Revelation chapter 3 and verses 17 and 18, where it says, "Because thou sayest, I am rich and increased with goods, and have need of nothing, and knowest not that thou art wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. Accumulate all the wealth of the world," and I'm not, as this series has already proven, I'm not against wealth, "but accumulate all the wealth in the world and have not what really counts, the real wealth, and you're miserable, wretched, and poor." And it goes on in verse 18, "I counsel thee therefore to buy of me gold," real gold, "that's tried in fire, that thou mayest be rich, and white raiment, that thou mayest be clothed, and that thy shame of thy nakedness does not appear, and anoint thine eyes with eye salve, that thou mayest see." End of that quote. Talking about the real wealth that only God provides. Here's another non-essential area. We just talked about houses or homes having to go into debt to have a home. Here's another non-essential area that is often considered essential. Weddings. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't have weddings. But, do you have any idea how much the average United States wedding costs? According to the March 2003 issue of the Ladies' Home Journal, and for any of you smart alecks, no, I've not been reading the Ladies' Home Journal. Somebody sent this to me. But according to the March 2003 issue of the Ladies' Home Journal, in an article entitled The State of the Union, Lisa Benson pointed out that the average United States wedding cost, the average one, taken from the extreme to the lowest, the average United States wedding cost, are you ready for this? $23,600. 50 years ago, $500 would have bought an elaborate church wedding. $50 billion is spent on weddings every year in the United States of America, and even more on the divorces. Now let me tell you, buying a fancy wedding doesn't promise anything as it concerns a good marriage. Because half or more churches, church people and non-church people alike are ended up in divorce, and they're paying that much or more for them. But I hope you're seeing this again. There's something wrong with the picture here, as there always is in Babylon. What a way to start a life together. But a couple might think to themselves and say, yeah, but that's daddy's expense, not mine. Oh, yeah? Do you really think that a $22,000 or whatever it cost wedding isn't going to affect your future inheritance? So who's paying? Girls, let me tell you, unless your daddy's a millionaire, and I ain't one of them, forget the show and the pomp and the circumstance and do it simple and do it cheap. And who cares about what other people think? I didn't think it was near as funny when I put that in my notes. Glad you got a chuckle out of it. I'm not just talking to mine. I'm talking to yours, too. My dad can be thankful. He doesn't have to have weddings this day and age. He had 6 girls. My goodness, at $20,000 a shot, none of us would have an inheritance. Here's another one. How about having babies? You're going to tell me that's not essential? Well, although in emergencies, which are few and far between, now some of you I know this isn't, we don't have to worry about this anymore, but I'm talking about to the younger generation here. Except for those emergency situations, which again are very few and far between, in fact, they'll like to make emergency situations out of situations that aren't, anytime they can. Boy, they love those Caesarean sections, you know. Any reason to do that, a lot more money. But except for emergency situations, don't go to the hospitals to have your babies. Seems like there was a whole generation, hundreds of generations before this quote-unquote modern generation that we live in today and that we have been in, say, in the last 100 years, that never went to hospitals to have babies. Isn't that amazing? Seems like God just made it happen natural. Don't go to hospitals. They're not essential. To have your babies, have them at home. You'll save at least 2/3 of what it'll cost you at a hospital. And it's more natural. And you ask any woman, any lady who's had them in both places, you ask them which is more natural. And it's safer, too. Statistics have proven now that that's becoming more the norm, that it's much more safer at home as well. And let me guarantee you, having one of ours at home and 3 of us in the hospital, I guarantee you there isn't anybody in our household who won't say that it was a much, much more blessed event when we did it at home.
I'm just trying to give you some examples to try to get some... We need to think, you know, to see that there's other ways to do things than how everybody says it's to be done or the norm that's today. Going back to hospital birth, in 1991, hospital birth cost an average of $5,382. That was the earliest date I could get some data on. Whereas home births with the assistance of a midwife cost an average of $1,591, about a third of what it would be. And if you really want to save some money, after the first one or two babies, you got your wife feeling a little more comfortable about it, fathers, why not deliver your own babies? Is there any reason you can't do it any better than a midwife? And it won't cost you a thing, just like God intended it to be. And I'm not so sure that this high price of having babies isn't a part of trying to keep us from having babies. You know, God intends us to multiply. Well, you can't multiply if it starts, you know, it's hard to multiply if you got to pay $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 every crack you have a baby. Puts you further and further into debt. But save some money, fathers, and have your own babies. In fact, you'll be saving $5,000. And the more you have, if you want to look at it that way. Listen to me. When living in quote-unquote Egypt, or quote-unquote Babylon, the cards are stacked against you. And therefore, you have to think... You have to think outside their box. It's their box. We shouldn't want anything to do with their box. Because the man, let me tell you, who can save money in this day and age is not a miser. He's a wizard. But let me tell you, it can be done. If we just be creative and think outside their box. Back to living within our means. Will Rogers once said, quote, "The time to save is now. When a dog gets a bone, he doesn't go out and make a down payment on a bigger bone. He buries the one he's got." End of quote. He was a cowboy too. Pretty wise. Hebrews 13:5 says, "Let your conversation be without." Your behavior is the better word there. King James uses conversation for that idea. Says, "Let your conversation or behavior be without covetousness," always wanting and looking for something more. "And be content," we're talking about living within your means, "be content with such things as you have, for he has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee." End of that quote. Paul wrote to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 6. He said, "But godliness with contentment is great gain." I might even add that as one of the principles. Contentment is probably should be. Contentment is a biblical economic principle. The Greek word translated contentment is the same word translated sufficiency in 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 8. Paul wrote that, quote, "And God is able to make all grace toward you," or excuse me, "all grace abound toward you, that ye always having all sufficiency in all things may abound to every good work." In other words, because Yahweh provides, he promises right there for his people, those who are abiding by his principles, because Yahweh promises to provide all that you need, if you are looking to go into debt for something of a non-essential or non-emergency nature, then it's almost certainly something that God never intended you to have in the first place. Because it says he provides all. And sometimes if we'd not run so quickly to the banker or some loan agent and go to God, we might find he'll give us the desires of our heart without ever having to do that. But we tend to go to them and make them a God rather than trusting in our God. Someone once described contentment in the following terms. It says, he said that, quote, "the power to get out of every situation, all that there is in it." I like that definition for contentment rather than how we would otherwise probably view contentment. You know, contentment sometimes is almost viewed as lazadaisical, how do you say that? Lackadaisical or almost a slumber. You know, you've got no motivation. That's not the kind of contentment the Bible teaches. The power to get out of any situation all that there is in it. It's similar to the idea of making your dollars stretch, or better yet, of making your money work for you rather than just simply working for money. Now, if it's not your natural inclination to be content or to live within your means, just think about this for a moment. You might want to ponder this from time to time. Just think how happy you would be if you were to lose everything that you presently have and then suddenly get it all back. You'd be thrilled. And you wouldn't be thinking about what you don't have. That ought to help curb any desire to indulge ourselves on any and everything that happens to come along. One of the fruits of the Spirit is self-control. Fruits of the Spirit are love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. The last of the nine fruits of the Spirit. Self-control, that is to control our fleshly passions. That's how we normally think of it. But also our material desires. That takes self-control as well. We live today in an intense advertisement environment that is geared to cause us to be impulse buyers. And we are just inundated with that kind of advertisement. Well, let me tell you, impulse buying is the opposite of being self-controlled. That's what it is. Now, I'm talking about other than non-essentials and emergencies. So, with that in mind, let me provide you with three steps to help control impulse buying. Number one, evaluate each and every purchase, which means that you'll have to put some time, and some thought into each and every purchase before making the purchase. If it's non-essential, make it your policy. I will never buy on the impulse. Or, oh, there it is, I'm going to get it. That I've got to step back, I've got to allow a certain amount of time, and I've got to think about it, and I've got to allow that time to pass before I make the purchase. No on-the-spot purchases, period. Proverbs 18:15, I think, is a good passage for that. It says, quote, "The heart of the prudent getteth knowledge, and the ear of the wise seeketh knowledge." Doesn't make a on-the-spot decision. You know, as a male, I think we tend to do this more than women, and women probably have a problem with more impulse buying, I would suspect, than men do, because men tend to like to gather all the information in that they can. You know, and I'm sure I frustrate Linda and the children sometimes because my answer is maybe or possibly, or until I have to make the decision, I don't know what's going to happen between now and then, so I'm not going to say yes until I've got all the information I can gather. Well, you gather knowledge and understanding. You give it some time. Let that impulse wear off and evaluate the situation a little bit. Number two, categorize every potential purchase. Ask yourself, is this what I want, something that I desire, or is it a necessity? Ecclesiastes 6:9 says, "Better is the sight of the eyes, what you have already, than the wandering of the desire. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit." And then number three, and maybe these should be switched in order, by the way, but number three, as I'm giving it to you this morning, is buy on a cash basis. Romans 13:8 again says, "Owe no man anything." Owe no man anything. Now, that's not always possible, but as far as it is in your power to do so, owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loveth one another fulfilleth the law. You know, it should go without saying that credit cards should not be a part of our economic arsenal. And again, as I've shared this over in other messages in the past, but don't think that one of the first credit cards, that it was just by happenstance that one of the first credit cards was dubbed MasterCard. Now, I don't know if they had that in mind, but God is sovereign. I'll guarantee you He had it in mind. He allowed the first one to be called a MasterCard because that's what it becomes when you go into debt to those loan agents. You know, they have made it as easy as they possibly can for us to buy. Well, let me tell you, you're a whole lot less likely to buy something with a check than you are with a credit card. And you're less likely to purchase something with cash than you are with a check. It's just harder to get rid of those babies. Credit cards and checks are much easier than to hand over that cash, that those Federal Reserve notes, even if they aren't worth anything. It just is tougher. So go cash if you can. The same is even more true if you convert your cash, those Federal Reserve notes, into something that's truly of value like gold and silver. You want to talk about hard to hard to hand to somebody? It's when you got the real stuff in your hand. Employ those three steps, and I guarantee that it will at least help from that impulse to go into debt. Principle number 8, and I cannot stress this enough, is whatever you do, do whatever you have to stay or get out of debt. That is, to live within your means. Now, if you live by the first 8 biblical principles that we've covered in these 14 messages, let me assure you, Yahweh, in some fashion, is going to bless you for that. That's a part of His promise. And therefore, you are very likely to find yourself in the position of the lender and not the borrower. Praise Yahweh, eh? Won't that be nice? And therefore, we need to discuss biblical economic principle number 9. Because someday we might find ourselves in the position of the lender and not the borrower. Biblical economic principle number 9 is, anybody ahead of me? If you're the lender, do not charge usury. The Bible is very clear that Yahweh does not allow for His people to charge His people or their own people usury. And yet the sad fact of the matter is, most Christians are not only being robbed of their money by the usurers, but most Christians today are users themselves without even realizing it. Now, we'll get back to that in the next message. Let me first establish, though, that usury is condemned in the Bible, not once, but many times, and is therefore in opposition to the moral nature of our God. Let's begin by turning to Exodus 22, and I don't know how many of these we'll get through, but we'll just go until the tape runs out here, and then we'll pick it up with the next message. Exodus chapter 22, and just verse 25. We're just going to go through these in sequential matter as we find them in the Bible. Exodus 22 and verse 25, it says, "If thou lend money to any of my people that is poor by thee, thou shalt not be to him an usurer, neither shalt thou lay upon him usury." I don't know. Take that verse just by itself. Seems pretty clear to me, doesn't it to you? There's no ambiguity whatsoever in that verse. We are not to charge usury. Now somebody say, well, just what is usury? There's different definitions today about usury. All right, well, let's go to the word and what it means in the Hebrew. Strong's, it's number 5392. It's the Hebrew word neshek, and it comes from 5391. Here is Strong's definition, simply, quote, "interest on a debt," end of quote. Not excessive interest, just interest on a debt. It comes from 5391 with his nashak, which is even more interesting. It's a primitive root, according to Strong's, quote, "to strike with a sting as a serpent," figuratively to oppress with interest on a loan, end of quote. Therefore, usury is simply interest on anything loaned. Therefore, today's banking system, let's make the application, today's banking system is ungodly And it's condemned in the Bible. Let's move on. Leviticus 25. And beginning with verse 35. It says, "And if thy brother be waxen poor, and fallen in decay with thee, then thou shalt relieve him, yea, though he be a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with thee. Take thou no usury of him, or increase, but fear thy God, that thy brother may live with thee. Thou shalt not give him thy money upon usury, nor lend him thy victuals for increase." So there again, it's repeated, we are not to charge usury of our brother. Now, also in verse 37, it says that we're also not to lend him thy victuals for increase. The two words for increase comes from the Hebrew word marbith, which is defined by Strong's as a multitude, also offspring, specifically interest on capital. So it was another word concerning not as often used as the other word, but another word dealing with charging interest. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verses 19 and 20. Verse 19, it says, "Thou shalt not lend upon usury to thy brother," meaning a fellow Israelite, "usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury." Verse 20, "Unto a stranger," in this case speaking of a non-Israelite, "unto a stranger thou mayest lend upon usury, but unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon usury, that Yahweh thy God may bless thee in all that thou settest thine hand to in the land whither thou goest to possess it." Now, so, taking now the three passages that we've presently looked at, the sum of Yahweh's word on this issue is that we may not charge usury or interest to a fellow Israelite, but we may charge usury or interest of non-Israelites. And to that, someone is probably going to yell, "Prejudice, partiality, bias." Well, yell all you want. It won't do you any good. The fact is, Yahweh is prejudiced toward his people, was prejudiced to national Israel in the past, and is prejudiced today to his bride today, who is spiritual Israel from amongst those Christians from amongst Israel, or the nation of Israel. There's many passages that certainly prove that, and you can cut them out of your Bibles, but they're still going to be there. Exodus 19:4-6, for example, you might want to go read it. I would encourage you to, there's that statement therein that says, "Ye," speaking of Israel, "shall be a peculiar," or New American Standard says, "special treasure unto me above all people." So, yell all you want. And if that doesn't fit your conception of God, let me be blunt, that's your problem. You've simply attempted to put Yahweh into a box of your own making, or one created by today's politically correct society in which simply he doesn't fit. You can make the box, but he, no matter how big you make the box, he don't fit in it. Excuse my language, or my English. But that's another message for another time. I'm going to skip over Nehemiah chapter 5. Let's go to Psalms. We'll come back to that probably in the next message. Psalms chapter 15, if you will. Psalms chapter 15, and again, I'm going through all of them because I want you to see that there is absolutely no question that the banking system which we have today, the usurious system, usury in any sense, charging interest on anything of our brethren, is absolutely condemned in the Bible. Psalms 15, beginning with verse 1, it says, "Yahweh, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill? He that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh the truth in his heart. He that backbiteth not with his tongue, nor doth evil to his neighbor, nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor, in whose eyes a vile person is condemned. But he honoreth them that fear Yahweh. He that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not. He that putteth not out his money to usury, nor taketh reward against the innocent. He that doeth these things shall never be moved." Now, do you want to abide? That starts off with abiding in the tabernacle of Yahweh and in His holy hill. Do you want to abide in the tabernacle of Yahweh and abide in His holy hill? Not everyone does. But I think I'm speaking here and those in the tape ministry that we want to abide in His tabernacle and on His holy hill. Well, if you do, I strongly recommend, among other things that are listed there as well, that you do not charge usury or interest of your brethren. I don't know, can you glean anything else from that passage? That's all it provides for us. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 28. Probably didn't know there was this much on usury, but there indeed is. And by the way, once is enough. We've got at least six or more admonitions that we are not to be involved in this. We'd better take heed to it. Once would be enough, but he said it over and over again, wanted to get through to us. Proverbs chapter 28, verse 9, it says, "He that turneth away his ear from hearing the law, even his prayer shall be an abomination." Now, it's an interesting verse, especially in light of Isaiah 59, 1 and 2. It says, "He that heareth not his law, even his prayer shall be an abomination." He won't hear it. Isaiah 59, 1 and 2 says that God's hands is not so short that it cannot save, or his ear so dull that he cannot hear. "But your sins have made a separation between you and your God that he cannot save, and your iniquities have," something similar to that, "so that he cannot hear." Now, which is it, not listening to the law or sinning? Well, the two go hand in hand. If you know 1 John chapter 3 and verse 4, because there we find that everyone who practices sin also practices lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. So we're talking about one and the same thing. And God says, you don't partake, you don't listen to my law. The inevitable result of that is sin. I won't hear your prayers. Your prayers will even be an abomination to me. And a part of that law is Yahweh's prohibition against usury. Look at the verse that precedes verse 9. Verse 8. "He that by usury and unjust gain increases his substance, he shall gather it for him that will pity the poor. He that turneth away his ear from hearing the law, even his prayer shall be an abomination." The very law that he was dealing with, according to the context, was that law concerning prohibitions against usury. Now, one more. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 18. Ezekiel chapter 18 and verse 13, where we find the following. It says, "Has given forth upon usury and has taken increase, shall he then live?" Talking about someone who has done that, who has given forth by usury and has taken increase. "Shall he then live?" the question is asked. "For he shall not live. He has done all of these abominations. He shall surely die. His blood shall be upon him." Now, in first reading that, we need to make a clarification here, because I assure you that there's a lot of our people who are preaching and using that verse in the wrong fashion. It appears from that verse that usury is so serious that it's a capital crime. It asks the question, shall he live? And he says, no, he shall not live. His blood shall be upon him. In other words, whoever he's talking about there, he says he should be stoned. However, usury, let me assure you, is not a capital crime. I read that years ago, and I had taken that same position because of that verse alone, and then I realized it said, "He shall not live, for he has done all of these abominations." And I realize then we have to look at the context. You go back to verse 10, and there's a whole lot more involved with this usurer than just usury. Let's start with verse 10. It says, "If he beget a son that is a robber, a shedder of blood," so there's a capital crime right there, he was a murderer, "and that doeth the like to any one of these things, and that doeth not any of those duties, but even has eaten upon the mountains, and defileth his neighbor's wife," there's idolatry and adultery, both capital crimes, "has oppressed the poor and needy, has spoiled by violence, has not restored the pledge, and has lifted up his eyes to the idols," idolatry again, "has committed abomination, has given forth upon usury, and has taken increase, shall he then live? He shall not live. He has done all of these abominations. He shall surely die. His blood shall be upon him." So let me clarify the fact that usury is not a capital crime. It was just one of a list of many things that this young man was involved in. But do not miss that he was being condemned, and it was one of the sins, and look at the company that God did put it with. Now, with all of those passages in mind, is there any question that Yahweh condemns usury? Yeah, but that's Old Covenant, preacher. And Yahshua changed that Old Covenant law regarding usury in his parable concerning the talents. And therefore, usury is now okay under the new covenant. Well, if you're prone to be thinking that way, are you so sure about that? Think for a minute about the implications of that position that I just reiterated, especially as it pertains to Yeshua, our Savior. And I'll leave you with this message to think about that. Think about the implications of that as it regards Yeshua the Christ. Because if what is so often declared about usury under the new covenant is true, because of that parable, if that is true, then let me tell you, this is how serious that is, or what the implication of that would be. And that is that if that is true, then Yeshua cannot be our Savior. Now, you go read Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 and 18. We'll look at that passage, and we're going to look at that parable and hopefully rightly divide the word concerning it, because I assure you it doesn't say what most people are interpreting it to say. It says the exact opposite. There's no fashion that Yeshua changed the law. And keep in mind, that was while he was living. If he changed the law, then he was a sinner and couldn't be our Savior. I already gave it away. Wanted you to think about it some. We'll talk some more about that in the next message. In the meantime, we've covered nine principles, quote unquote covered, nine principles of biblical economics. Number one, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. Number two, seek wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. Number three, seek work. Number four, tithing, free will, offerings, and charitable contributions. Number five, efficient and effective time management. Number six, Sabbath. Number seven, save, save, and save. Number eight, stay out of debt. And number nine, do not charge usury. We'll deal more with usury in the next message and move on from there. All right, let's stand and we'll close this in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you and praise and glorify your holy name for all that you are. We magnify you and for all that you've granted and given us, Father, through Christ first. For through his death, burial, and resurrection, his atoning blood sacrifice that makes all possible. And then for the instruction, Lord, you continually have blessed us with through your word. Let our people be awakened. Let us return to your principles in this area and in all areas of life, that your kingdom might be established here on earth as it is in heaven. We glorify, praise, and magnify you in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.